So we left him a little anxiously in London and went on ahead to Zimbabwe. He was to follow later, but first we were going back through his writing to the roots of his fight with colonialism, back into the past of the House of Hunger.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. We are back. Thank you for waiting. It's been quite an eventful couple of months. There's been a lot of strange developments happening. I'm sure personally and abstractly for a lot of people out there. And there are two books during that time last month that I read in probably like 3 days. And I kind of wanted to talk about them a little bit because I think they're prescient and they're fiction. So, or they're autobiographical in some regards. I mean, all fiction is somewhat autobiographical because it's representational from the standpoint of the author or the artist or whoever. But they kind of struck me in a really sort of heavy way. One of them is Dambudzo Marachera's, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, House of Hunger. And the other is Harry Crews, The Feast of Snakes. And I want to do a bit of like comparative analysis here, going into kind of like both of these books, because I think they're really sort of timely in a strange way. You know, they kind of touch on a type of barbarism that I think is kind of like prescient, you know. And there's, you know, humorous elements. They're really profane, very controversial kinds of books too. And this isn't to say that it's controversy for controversy's sake. I think that they're sort of accurate portrayals of the landscape that they take place in. And, you know, to give a little bit of background, I'd say we should just start with Dambudzo Marachera first, who was a Zimbabwean writer who had a lot of mental health issues, and alcoholism was kind of like this true bohemian. And he, you know, very sort of controversial. And this book was wildly popular. It won the Guardian Award. But, you know, still he couldn't escape his kind of like demons. And I think that that's really kind of fascinating that even though this book had success, the sort of traumas of his past kind of caught up with him. And I think this book is, you know, it's extremely offensive. I'd say they're both of them are very offensive, but they're not done in this spirit to just kind of provoke. They're done as a way of, you know, alleviating personal, I think, some sort of like personal trauma. And, you know, House of Hunger, I think, is a really sort of interesting book because on one hand, it could be seen as a kind of like a really classic example of post-colonial fiction. But because some of the language and portrayals, specifically females, of female characters could be seen as like a bit misogynistic, it didn't really get that kind of treatment as a kind of like work of, you know, quote unquote leftist artistic canon, you know, which is kind of ironic because you think of things that are sort of white that do, it's always this kind of like LARPy version, you know, the May 68 thing. You could see, I think there's kind of new way of reappropriating old sort of bourgeois political LARPs and reintegrating them under these new forms of barbarism. But Dambudzo Marachera, he kind of really tells it like it is. And he has a very strange, poetic, aphoristic style of writing. And his life was just absolutely butt nuts crazy. You know, like you know, he is a true nutter. And I mean that in like the best way possible. And, you know, he's a fascinating writer. I was just kind of like really sort of, I've been wanting to read him for a while. And, you know, a friend actually had mentioned that he was going through and trying to read every single work of his. And I was like, oh, you know what? I should read House of Hunger too. And I was really kind of blown away by how stylistic it was, like the poetic style, the reuse of the word stains and trying to sort of map this personal and historic lineage. And he died young too. He died in 1987 of AIDS and HIV, and he was squatting. He was homeless. He just, you know, he couldn't escape the demons. And I think this book is a really sort of interesting example of a kind of demonology, you know, or trying to, you know, sort of face the demons so you can expel them. And there's this really interesting, it's like a half fictionalized, half documentary on the House of Hunger. It's on YouTube. So if you want to watch that, I highly recommend it. And when you hear him talk, it's like, you know, this is somebody who is not really comfortable. You know, you can really sort of sense the unease and the trauma and all these other, I think, weird, he has very strange, bizarre speech patterns and mannerisms. I think this book is a really interesting look at the state of apartheid. And this is a state that I think people can, you know, further and further resonate with. I know Russell Means said that, you know, the world is becoming an Indian reservation, and under, you know, the technate or the technocracy that we see today, we can sort of see, we have this feeling of this encroaching authoritarian public sphere that is kind of faceless. You know, the word panopticon gets thrown around quite a bit. It's a little bit cliche at this point, but for lack of better terminology, I think it still kind of holds up. So I kind of want to give an intro to Domodzo Mrachera. He was born in 1952 in southern Rhodesia, which, you know, Rhodesia is infamously, a lot of this centers around Ian Smith's Rhodesia and what it's like to grow up in apartheid. But it, again, it's not really orthodox. And he specifically rejects stuff like black nationalism. He has this amazing quote. He said, if you're a writer for a specific nation or a specific race, then fuck you. You know, Mrachera was really sort of against any kind of tribalism and also traditional forms of identity. And he saw identity as fluid. You know, you could almost see him as almost a queer icon in a sense. And you know, he didn't believe it could be confined to race, nationality, or culture, which kind of also explains the fact that he was, in his autobiography, kind of talks about how he was looked down on because he, you know, they sort of patronizingly referred to him as William Shakespeare because he liked Western writers during a time when there was a sort of a heavy nationalist, pan-Africanist fervor going on during that time. And you know, he was really sort of influenced by specifically Franz Kafka. And he felt kind of alienated from both African culture and the West.
That's why, for instance, in the House of Hunger, there is a total dislocation of any sort of contacts. The only time people actually meet is when they are brutalizing each other. I think my fiction is also an attempt to reorder my surroundings in such a way that the brutality underneath has some sort of shimmer which can make it humane. I think in terms of language, England beat me because I'm still using the English language. You can even listen to my voice and hear some of the Oxford sort of influences. Even my own voice is no longer my own. It's like a madman trying to shield his own madness beneath, as it were, an acquired roof in some weird hotel where he doesn't really know what's going on.
So, you know, and so Africans kind of saw him as disconnected from his roots, and Westerners were kind of confused by his refusal to conform to any label. He saw the imposition of identity as something that was inherently authoritarian in any kind of even a historical context. So almost similar to, you could say, Jacques Derrida's views of like marginality as being this thing that's kind of fluid, you know, like there's always going to be minorities, and the minority is something that we should respect and uphold, but that definition is always sort of changing. You know, one person's minority today, especially now, and you can see the minority becomes the hegemon, and these turnovers, they happen so quickly. You know, when people talk about the great unwashed masses, you know, there was some, I think, truth to the fact that the base of MAGA at one point represented the margins, and now, I mean, it's, unless you're one of these people in there, but they just don't know it yet. But now that it has hegemonic power with all of these kind of, you know, it kind of changes that definition, and we can kind of roll back and say, whoa, you know, like there are other, let's go back to some of these other minorities as well and sort of and try to take a holistic view of what minoritarianism is. And Catherine Malibu had a really sort of good lecture. She's a philosopher who I really like on sort of on wokeism and what is wokeness, and is it a Western thing? Is it an American thing? Is it a French thing? And, you know, she had a lot of quips with the terminology, but she, again, as a Derridian, she sort of takes this view that it has to evade capture. It has to go back to the spark, like deconstruction and minoritarianism has to go back to the spark or the essence of what it is rather than these fixed stationary categories. So I can talk about a little bit about that later. But I thought it was kind of, you know, this book just really struck me. It was like extremely dark and extremely profane, and not, even though it's coming from this place of liberation and minoritarianism and overcoming oppression.
The House of Hunger had become my mind, and I didn't like the way the roof was rattling. The foul breath of our history fanned the heat of our thirst. All the black youth was thirsty. The freedom we craved was so alive in our breath that we became drunk before we had found it.
Let's go inside and drink the good Lord's health.
If it sticks, I might as well go down in style.
What?
So he grew up in southern Rhodesia. His dad was a truck driver, and his mother did domestic work. And his father was an adulterer, and that's a big, that plays a big part of the book as well. And so his life, you know, he witnessed violence and social injustice, and this really influenced his writing. His dad died when he was young, and so to escape this, he got into academics. You know, he got into reading. He was always reading, always writing. So this is basically like the story of a nerd who's trying to escape his conditions. And he got into a pretty prestigious school, a St. Augustine's Mission School, which hosted kind of some of the brightest minds. He always sort of clashed with authority figures everywhere he went. You know, he was extremely rebellious, like a true anarch, like very anarchistic in his view, the way he dealt with people. I mean, when he got sent to Oxford, he was expelled for trying to burn the school down. I mean, it is like really, I love it because you don't hear about people this but crazy anymore. Everything is so milquetoast, I think, And, you know, I think his, you know, his death drive was just so strong, but it also created this like incredibly colorful life and personality. And so he won a scholarship to the University of Rhodesia, and he studied English literature, but he was expelled because he was involved in the student protest against the colonial government. But he ended up receiving this Commonwealth scholarship to study at the University of Oxford in England, which is one of the most prestigious schools in the world. I think it's something like third now, or I don't know. This school doesn't really mean the same thing as it used to. I don't really know much about colleges, honestly. I couldn't really tell you much about the state of them now. I think back when the library system was a little bit more important and information was a bit more gatekept, you can see that, you know, having these repositories of knowledge, you know, especially like the Oxford Library, they were incredibly important in sculpting the education of people. But now it's like all bets are off and, you know, everything just turns to slop anyway. So he had a lot of conflicts with his professors. He accused them of being racist and rigid intellectually. And he also struggled with authority, and he was known for his erratic behavior, which kind of fueled his mental health issues and his heavy drinking. You know, they kind of went hand in hand. And eventually he was expelled for being disruptive. And by disruptive, I mean really disruptive, meaning he tried to burn the school down. And he drifted around England, living as this kind of homeless bohemian flaneur in London parks and squatting in buildings. And this is when he wrote his most famous book, The House of Hunger. And it was a short story collection that, you know, there's the main story, which is House of Hunger, and there's these auxiliary stories that kind of go along with it that, you know, very sort of languidly and poetically describe the alienation and oppression of colonial Rhodesia. And it was a sensation, you know, won the Guardian Fiction Prize. And it, you know, it was experimental, but really direct. But the success didn't stabilize his life because he just became a worse alcoholic. And, you know, if you have untreated alcoholism, you can find yourself in, you know, any kind of situation, no matter what kind of a claim you have, you know. So he continued to squat. And in part of this documentary, it starts with him in his squat. He's like acting really erratically. It's almost like he's undergoing this passionate psychosis. But, you know, after Zimbabwe gained its independence in 1980 from the colonial government, Marichera, he returned home in 1982. And in this documentary, you can kind of see him returning home, and he's like jumping around and screaming, and he's just really weird, like what chicken-like mannerisms. And it's like, you know, it's really interesting to watch him as like a figure, because he's just so wild, you know, and he's so idiosyncratic.
I'm back home, and Zimbabwe Airport. I'm really back home. Hey, look. The first time in 8 years. Yeah, thanks. Oh, the back one. Yeah, good. I'll just get it as my duty-free goods.
But as he sort of tells biographically, you know, he kind of struggles to fit into the new nation. And part of it was because he didn't embrace Zimbabwean nationalism. He was really critical of Robert Mugabe, and he rejected nationalism entirely, left wing, right wing. He was completely against this idea of, like, you know, a national identity or authority or a kind of proletarian identity or whatever. He really was kind of almost truly like a Russian, like cosmic nihilist in that sense. You know, he was very influenced by Tolstoy as well. So you can really sense this like Tolstoy-like disposition in his writing. And you can see that there's a pretty clear correlation. And, you know, his radical views and his erratic behavior, it really alienated him from the kind of literary circles in his home country that were very focused on, you know, praising the new government and, you know, praising the nation. And so he lived on the streets and he just kept being an alcoholic. And he tried to establish this writing career, but he was too difficult to work with. And so he kept writing, and in 1984, he finally published Black Sunlight, which is a really experimental novel that was totally censored in Zimbabwe for its very radical, subversive themes. You know, truly, this guy is like, he was willing to suffer almost like forever, you know, until it ended him at the age of 35. And then his final one was Mind Blast from 1984, which is this weird mix of poetry, prose, and drama. And it is a real expression of intellectual defiance and of what a life of total chaos, lived chaos, looks like. So eventually he contracted HIV and AIDS. He was, you know, in this book, there's a lot of, you know, talk about prostitution. You know, prostitution is a heavy recurring theme in a lot of his works. So he ended up contracting AIDS, which is what killed him. And, you know, this death kind of, it was a real sort of tragic end to this genius who just had this like insane fire in him. And his life was just filled with just incredible brilliance and absolute holistic rebellion and suffering. And there's something really kind of beautiful. You know, it's James Joycean in a lot of the existentialism, but it's not a kind of like disgusting nihilism. It's more, he's really trying to figure these things out. There is actually a real sort of spiritual dimension to it, similar to Kafka, I think, you know, and similar to Tolstoy. And obviously after he dies, he gets heralded as, you know, one of the most original thinkers, you know, and so his writing has these themes of alien, just completely anti-establishment and a complete unwillingness to give in, you know, and just a complete rejection of the world, which is almost, it's like quasi-religious in a sense. He was heavily admired and also heavily criticized, was very critical of Zimbabwean nationalism, which is kind of unusual for writers in a newly independent country. So a lot of the writers at the time, they celebrated independence and the struggle against colonialism, but he saw like all forms of power, colonial, black nationalist, as oppressive. So he wouldn't glorify Mugabe. And Mugabe was, you know, I don't think retrospectively you can say he was some like hero. I mean, he did a lot of horrible things, regardless of what, you know, people who are highly online might say. You cannot overlook that. And his refusal to align with these actually ethno-nationalist ideals, they kind of made him an outcast. And people started to see him as a traitor to the African cause and a threat to the government. You know, he was a threat everywhere he went. And he had this such a chaotic and fragmented modernist kind of style, which really sort of set him at odds with the traditional African literature, which was oral storytelling, cultural heritage, political struggle. And it was also deeply personal. It was almost like a work of autofiction. But unlike people in New York, he's not everybody, but, you know, there's a certain type of person with a very mundane background who feels the need to biographize that, you know, kind of status quo existent. He really sort of explored these themes of alienation and mental illness, urban decay, rather than a kind of national identity. And the violent and explicit portrayal of brutality and psychological torment, sex, you know, I was trying to do some research, and a lot of the criticisms were of feminists. They say, you know, he's very misogynistic. And you can definitely see that in the book, but part of it is like he's portraying the dominant attitudes of growing up in that situation, in that environment, and how people just saw gender relations. It wasn't, I don't think he was overtly saying, you know, there's a part in the book where he's like, all white men are shit, all black men are shit, women are shit. He just kind of was just like, well, everybody's just kind of grotesque, you know, and it's a real sort of rebellion against that innate grotesqueness that sort of permeates everything. So also, when he won the Guardian Fiction Prize at the ceremony in London, instead of giving a speech, he threw plates and glasses at the guests, which is like, I mean, he's so crazy. And so that was basically another thing. And then the aforementioned rejection of tribalism and a kind of national identity. If you are a writer for a specific nation or a specific race, then fuck you. He wanted to kind of write for anybody who would accept his message, you know. It already had a kind of, like, it has a built-in mechanism that alienates people that is like, I can't touch this. Like, if you're willing to touch this, then it's for you, irregardless of who you are. But otherwise, it is just like, it's true rebellion, you know. It's just an absolute rejection of authority, of worldly authority in all its forms. And it's so provocative. And it's one of the most provocative things I've ever read. Like, it is really, you can see, kind of offensive.
Peter kept talking about the bloody whites. The phrase seemed to be roasting his mind. And because he hungered for the fight, everyone saw it in his eyes and liked him for it. But the shell of the sky cracked. It was immaculate he fought. And as he beat her, those eyes stung him to a greater fury. It was me she turned to, yet I clung desperately to a tiny straw of loathing for her.
Avenue around Rhodes' statue to watch the parade of Rhodesia's fighting forces on land and in the air. The motorcycle escort of the BSAP leads the way. Cecil John Rhodes gazes down on the army's motorized units. Thank you. Mission Combined Services were host to the South African Defense Force in a match watched by the President, the Honorable Clifford DuPont.
There's a pretty interesting YouTube video called Woke, Wokeism, Reawakening, Difference. Difference in the sort of Derridian sense. So to make a kind of distinction there, by the philosopher Catherine Malibu, and this kind of came up on my algorithm, and it made some pretty incredible points. So to her, deconstruction has kind of died. You know, it's kind of ended. And so for her, you know, she's kind of talking about this new issue in contemporary politics of authoritarianism, how to reawaken difference so it doesn't get sort of recaptured. And there are some amazing quotes here. And I'll get into this, I guess you could say, like the crux or corpus of her thinking or philosophy. So Derrida, his entire project started via reawakening the philosophical project, which you could hear in the really long episode that we did on Francois Laruelle and his interest in reawakening philosophy by negating or sort of sidestepping the Occidental tradition and trying to find a alternate past path for philosophy that isn't sort of imbued with the kind of historical baggage of like the West. And so Derrida, he kind of started his project trying to reawaken philosophy, similar to like Husserl, who was trying to reactivate the original intention of geometry. And you sort of ask like, well, why would anybody do this? And it's because the sense of geometry became sedimented, and Derrida uses this word a lot, sediment. And it's so now the sense of deconstruction is currently sedimented, you know, and we think about marginality in these ways to kind of fold this sense of difference in that could break the hegemon, break the slot factory, break this kind of technocratic authoritarian turn. And so Derrida, he said, every advance or proposition of a new sense is always at the same time a leap and a fallback of sedimentary sense. So even in a reactionary revolution, it's still a kind of revolution of the new, because it's always expressing a way. So because it's based on a new sense. So if the old sense or the stagnant sense would be something like, I don't know, liberal democracy, what would the new sense would be something like an advance of reactionary thought. And that also entails a kind of relapse to sedimentary sense, or something that could be, even though it claims to be a kind of revolution, it's not actually a revolution. You're just sort of returning to this naive semblance of the past. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to reawaken the reactionary sense. And so in a lot of ways, 20th century leftist thought is very similar to right-wing fascist or reactionary thought. And it's trying to reawaken a sense, but it's always returning to a kind of Marxism. So in many ways, I think leftism is reactionary as well, because it's not trying to actually reawaken the substance of what was prescribed at a certain point. It's very much sort of a consumer identity or a costume. When this is kind of what Malibu says, in the kind of danger of, I don't know what you want to say, like wokeism. And she doesn't mean like it's not bad, like it's all bad or something. It's more nuanced and subtle than that. It's actually how to find a real wokeism, you know, to engage with the real of wokeism itself. And the first dangerous passivity are handed down and emptied of sense. So the reason these new senses get advanced is because the old ones become empty or hollow of their meaning. They become dilapidated, decrepit, and expressions of a kind of cynical naivete. And one way to think about this is the kind of difference, is there a difference between synthesis in the philosophical sense and difference, or difference in the Derridean sense? And this is kind of the problem that we run up against, is it all just postmodernism? Is there a deconstruction that sidesteps postmodernism? And this is kind of a question that she says, like, I don't really know. So one of the things she thinks about is sort of geometry, you know, how geometrical objects are transcultural, therefore they're transparent. They just are what they are. You know, the transcultural object or mathematics or something like that is a kind of foundational springboard. You know, and science doesn't permit itself to be enclosed by any historically determined culture. So the idea of science is an index of pure culture, and it designates culture's idols par excellence, because it speaks all languages, and the dream of universality can only refer to this Western paradigm.